Yeah, yeah, to go to the next thing. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, great.
Hello, hello, hello. Settle down, thank you very much. My name's Zoe Margolis. This is the Bill and Ben show. To my right is Bill Thompson, who is a writer, a journalist, a self-described tech critic and tame geek, who's playing with my hair. He's written for BBC, Arts Council and a whole bunch of others as well. Hello, Bill.
Hiya.
To my left is Ben Goldacre, who's a medical doctor, the writer of the Bad Science book and blog, writes for The Guardian, journalist, all-round good guy. Welcome, Ben. This talk is going to be divided into two halves. We're going to have Bill talking for about 15, 20 minutes and then some questions. And then Ben will talk as well for about the same time and some questions. And then we'll open up the floor a little bit at the end to some general questions. So let's begin.
Notice how the doctor gets described as general all-round good guy, whereas I'm just a geek because he can save her life in case of cardiac arrest on the stage, whereas I can't do anything other than perhaps blog or Twitter about it. It's always wise, you see, to know who in the audience is actually of real practical use to you and who's there just, as they put it in the loop, as meat in the room. Okay. My talk today, as you'll notice, is called The Ten Cultures Problem, but those of you who follow Think Geek and other places will know it's actually about the two cultures problem, but I wrote it in binary just to exclude those people who think that 10 is always a decimal integer. And so there are not going to be an additional 8 cultures described, there are just the two cultures. And the two cultures are basically us versus the rest of the world. Fortunately, we won. So I'm just here to let you know that we are the victors. And it's the rest of the world that's going to have to do some catching up, otherwise we will stomp them. As we saw from Tom and Tom earlier today, we have the power, we have the knowledge, we have the insight, and we're starting to flex our muscles. And they, the analog natives, are starting to listen. And if they don't listen, well, we'll just put them to the sword, as the Ottomans did in Constantinople in 1453. And that will be fine, because then we can loot their temples as well. This talk has come about because earlier this year I gave a lecture at Cambridge University in the computer lab on the same subject, inspired by the fact that 50 years ago, in May 1959, a guy who was described as a portly and imposing gentleman, Charles Prescott Snow, C.P. Snow, gave a lecture in the Senate House at Cambridge University, imposing building on King's Parade, some of you may know, in which he talked about the two cultures. And he was building on an article he'd written for the New Statesman previous year, and he then went on to turn the two cultures into not just a meme, but also basically something that dominated most of his later life. Snow was an interesting person in that he had been a practicing scientist, done some very good work. He'd also been a senior administrator in the British Civil Service and an advisor to government, and he was also a novelist. Although F.R. Leavis said he's not a novelist, he's just a writer, because Leavis hated him. And Snow's two cultures were that of the scientists, the people who, as he put it, knew what the second law of thermodynamics was, and the literary intellectuals who neither knew nor cared, who would be quite happy to sit down at a college dinner and refuse to talk to the mathematicians, because they're mathematicians, and what could we, who are running the country, learning classics, advising governments, possibly have in common with those who have corrupted their brains by thoughts of equations and practical matters. And Snow thought this was a bit of a tragedy. He thought it was a big mistake. In particular, although the two cultures as an idea over the last 50 years has evolved into something of a general point about the difference between scientists and artists, Snow thought it was a mistake for very practical reasons, which is that at the time he was writing in the 50s, just in post-imperial Britain, he thought the world was being run by people who did not properly understand the capabilities and potential of the technology of the time. So he felt that the civil servants and the administrators, the people running post-colonial India, the people who were trying to decide what to do about the problems of starvation in Africa, a very Western, white-oriented perspective, but those people, he felt, did not really see what was possible through the application of science-based technology. And he wanted to do something about it. The things he wanted to do about it were astonishingly patronizing and were basically about the white man going out and helping the poor natives to make better use of the fantastic inventions that had come out of European high culture so they could then model their societies and civilizations on the European model, vanquish poverty and do better. However, he was a particular man writing at a particular time, and he represented his past and his culture. That didn't mean that the problem he identified was not a valid one. That there was, and indeed many of you here will, I hope, admit, there still is a difference, a distinction between those who have what you might call a scientific sensibility, those of us who do actually know what the second law of the thermodynamics is and are comfortable with it, those who are happy to make jokes about sort of, I don't know, what's my favorite? Heisenberg is stopped for speeding, and the cop says to him, "Excuse me, sir, do you know how fast you were going?" He says, "No, but I know exactly where I was at the time." You see, and enough of you laughed at that joke for me to feel worthwhile. It's like Tom earlier saying, do I write URL or URI? You know, there are things which we understand. But when Snow was speaking in 1959, he was speaking to a world that was already changing. Because less than a quarter of a mile away from the Senate House where he gave his speech, the EDSAC, the Electronic Delay Storage Advanced Calculator, was running at Cambridge University in a building which had previously been an anatomy dissection lab, where the heat of the valves managed to make the smell of formaldehyde almost overwhelming as the fat that had seeped from all the bodies that had been dissected there over the years gradually evaporated to form a fug in which earlier computing began. EDSAC had been running for 10 years. There were other computers around in Manchester, in elsewhere in the UK, around the world. The Leo was being developed. The world was being changed, transformed by digital technologies, valve-based at the time, then transistor-based. Things were being transformed. And today, we live in a world which is dominated by digital technologies, by the network. 1.5 billion people have relatively straightforward access to the net. 3 or 4 billion people have mobile phones, more and more of which can access the net. It's still a minority occupation. We still need to think carefully about what happens to the next 5 billion users. But we cannot deny that the network and the technologies around the network are shaping the modern world. Politics, industry, commerce, banking, all of those rely on digital technologies and computers. In that world, in the world that we have helped to create, the important writing for many aspects of our lives is not literature, which Snow was talking about, but code. The stuff that makes the difference is not James Joyce's Ulysses or other works of modern literature which explore and reflect on what it is to be human, but millions of lines of COBOL and Fortran and C and JavaScript and even, God help me, Ruby and Perl. They make things happen. They define situations. They create a world. I'm with Lawrence Lessig here. Code is law. And very few people are properly literate in code. A lot of the world is functionally illiterate when it comes to written language, when it comes to whatever language they may be learning. Many more people are functionally illiterate when it comes to code. Now, Snow thought the division between the scientists and the literary intellectuals mattered because it meant that government missed out on the opportunities that technology had to offer, or worse, made the wrong choices. That when asked to judge the effectiveness of an industrialization program or a program to help out with agriculture in Africa or whatever, the things he cared about at the time that were intended to alleviate poverty, he felt that the wrong choices were being made precisely because those in a position to make those choices did not have the grounding in good scientific principles to allow them to make sensible judgments. And as a result, as he saw it, the poor of the world suffered unnecessarily. He believed at the time that there was enough food and enough sense and enough intelligence to feed the world, to free people from want, to free people from disease, if it was properly applied, but an understanding of science was core to doing that. Well, these days, the key question is not do you know what the second law of thermodynamics is, but do you know what recursion is? These days, the question is not, do you understand Newtonian physics versus Einsteinian physics, though I trust you all do, and there will be a test later, but do you know what it is that programmers do, how code operates, how the stuff that's written turns into programs that run on processors that shape people's lives? Do you know what an algorithm is? Do you know how one is formulated? Do you know how one is then turned into running code and how that shapes the possibilities that emerge from the digital devices all around us? Because not to know that, not to have that an awareness, leaves you on the wrong side of a real digital divide. It puts you in the power of people like us. Now, I'm comfortable with that because you're all nice, but I can see that others might not be just looking at this audience. The choices that we, those like us, make when implementing code, the choices that are made at the design stage, all those things shape the possibilities that emerge from the application of these devices. And the devices are becoming so central to our lives. The revolution that is happening is changing so many aspects of existence that we have to do something about it. We've heard today in various sessions about the ways in which the technological or an understanding of technology is important in making good political choices. We had the session from Tom Steinberg and Tom Loosemore asking questions about how do we design a system to bring, to make MPs' expenses transparent, to make bills work, okay? The political system needs to learn how to ingest and respect the wisdom of the geeks. It just has to happen because they will be called upon to build the systems which will, in 5 or 10 years' time, define what is politically possible. The systems that are built on the code base. We all know this works. We know how it works. We know how the code base translates into constraints and restrictions, but also into affordances and possibilities. But far few of the people who are going to be exercising, shall we say, political power in that world really understand what it is that we do and how it can be made better. And the Power of Information Report and Task Force did a fantastic job. People like Will Perrin have done a fantastic job. Tom Watson has done a great job as well. It's not enough because it does not go to the heart of the system. And if it doesn't go to the heart of the system, if we don't have a world in which the majority of people grasp at a very fundamental level what it is to program, not that they could do it for themselves, but what it is to program, grasp at a fundamental level what code looks like and how it controls a device, grasp at a fundamental level what network effects are, how things fit together, what an API is, what stacks are, all of that. Unless they understand that, they will be left increasingly powerless because the technology is built by people who do not care that their users do not understand, will come to dominate. Bad choices will be made, and we'll see two effects. The first is that we'll see the same sort of things that Snow was worried about. We'll see people who do have power, whether it's political power or business power, making wrong decisions. Right? We think government IT projects are bad now, just think how much worse it could get. So they'll make wrong decisions because they have budgetary authority or political authority and they use it wrongly. But we'll also see people underneath being to some extent exploited by the system. The debate about ID cards is a classic example where those who do not understand the problem have been allowed to focus on the issue of the card itself instead of the National Identity Register, which means nearly all of the politicking about it and what the Conservatives have been saying, and indeed the recent sort of announcements by the Culture Secretary, it was Justice Secretary, who was it who said the announcement? I can't remember now. Whoever it was in the government made the recent backtrack. They don't actually count for very much because they don't go to the heart of the system, but very few journalists, very few commentators, very few ordinary citizens are capable of the degree of systems thinking it takes to do something about it. So I want us all to go from this room today and dedicate ourselves to educating people. There's a few things we can do. We can start pushing now to get rid of the ICT classes in our schools that teach people how to format text effectively in Microsoft Word with proper computing and programming classes. Thank you. We can value ourselves and expect people to value us by having conversations at expensive dinner parties about coding and what we do. We can break through that barrier. If they're about to talk, if they're allowed to talk to us about Aeschylus, we're allowed to talk to them about Python. It just works that way. We can start to inject into popular culture some good role models. Buffy the Vampire Slayer is no longer with us, but what about Buffer the Overflow Slayer? And when Kevin Smith remakes Clerks, I want Jay and Silent Return. Come on, that's a good one. I want everybody to be able to laugh at those jokes, but also people to feel that talking about what code is and what it does and what programmers do is a fundamental part of our culture, of everyone's culture. Unless we do that, then we will have won, but what we will win will not be worth having. Snow wanted a world in which his idea of technocratic imperialism could dominate. He wanted to take some ideas from the West and give them to everyone else, but impose a model. I want something different. I want to work from the ground up. I think it's time for us to work much harder to ensure that the understanding of information systems, the understanding of coding, all of those things percolate popular culture, everyone's imagination. So when it comes to implementing these systems, people can take advantage of free and open source software because they know what those terms means and what it can do for them. It's not, as I say, that everyone should be a coder, but everyone needs to know what it is we do and why we do it so we can make the world a better place. And surely the reason we're all involved in this is to make the world a better place. I really do think if we don't bring down this barrier between these new two cultures, then we will end up with a world that remains unequal and divided and cruel to too many people, and that should not be allowed to happen. Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a few questions from the floor. Can I ask that you put your hands up and you stand up when you speak so that we can hear you clearly? Down here, the lady at the front.
That's no lady, that's Catherine Corrick. Okay, so the question is, who should we be looking to as role models, and where should we get the skills? Well, obviously, Richard Stallman is not a role model. hairy bearded men who smell of pizza, that you may go down well with the kids. Stallman is my hero, but he's not the sort of person we want to be pushing forward. I would actually say many of the people in this room. I mean, if I had to choose a bunch of people I would want to represent the possibilities, it would be all the people who work for my society, frankly. They are our popular heroes, and for the past 5 years, it's clear that they've done that. That sort of approach, and also the way they have worked so hard to explain what it is they are doing to people who actually don't yet know how to listen. So I'd say that sort of model. It is having, programmers you can relate to. They're nice people, they just happen to program as well. Okay? I know it sounds patronizing, but we're talking about changing people's attitudes. Perhaps we need to go to the editor of the Daily Mail, to Paul Dacre, and persuade him to run a campaign. Again, sadly, Gary McKinnon's possibly not the best role model for us to be putting forward at the moment as someone who should sort of inspire everyone. In the long term, though, I think, as with so many of the things, it's going to come with the kids. It's going to come up with actually changing the way that the education system works, perhaps looking at children's books, very few of which feature programmers or programming in any meaningful way. Learning how to tell old stories. My BBC column this week on the BBC website tries to represent The Tempest, Shakespeare's Tempest, as an analogy for the triumph of the digital culture. That clearly Prospero's books are a programming manual. That Ariel, trapped in a tree, is the spirit of the digital age, released by code to change the world, and Caliban, who sees himself as being the rightful inheritor of the island, is mainstream media, and particularly television, resisting as far as it can the digital world, but finally overthrown. So those sorts of analogies.
A gentleman with a white shirt, you had a question?
Speaking recently on his favourite subject of the joke of the economy, because everything is a fair step in the right direction, if the civil service
So the question is, picking up on a point that Ross Anderson, computer scientist, made, that the civil service entrance exam should have a section on programming in it, which sounds like a fine idea, given they're expected to be literate. How would you make it happen? Ah, that's a tricky one. If only there were some politicians in the building who could call upon to influence such things in meaningful ways. The answer is, I don't know how you would make that happen, frankly. I think that one's possibly pushing it a bit far. But, as somebody pointed out earlier, chances are between 12 and 18 months' time, there are going to be 300 new MPs. Okay? MPs at the moment do not have a standard induction process, but there are courses available to them. I know, because working for an MP, the website I helped to run advertises them. So we could prevail on the House of Commons authorities to offer a programming course to new MPs so they understand what's going on, and it will be run for free, and we might get some take-up. And then if all of their constituents wrote to them and said, I really hope you learn to program because then you'll understand, it might have some impact. So we could start with the MPs, and once the MPs can do it, civil servants will realise they have to do it too, otherwise they won't be able to answer the awkward questions. So what we need to do is to in fact, this is a good project. Okay, talk to me afterwards. Let's specify programming for MPs as a course, and we'll get it put on the standard curriculum for them. Deal.
Gentlemen at the back in the green.
Shout. Okay, it's a good question. So the point is that people don't tend not to go from the technology world into politics. So obviously we should all stand at the next election, okay? Deal? Choose your party. We could find a new party. Failing that, I think it's becoming less of a problem because technology now permeates all aspects of our lives. So 10 years ago, you might have somebody standing for Parliament who could say, oh, I've never used a keyboard. Now they've got a BlackBerry or an iPhone, stuff like that. And so there's leverage for helping them to appreciate the importance of technology, even if they don't actually have a formal background or haven't come from the industry. So in a sense, I think that problem is going away only because the technology is becoming more important, which is, of course, a reason why the issue becomes more important.
Chap in the back in the grey.
Okay, there are two points in there. The first is that whether programming is the appropriate thing for an MP. It's not that we want them to code, although Richard Allen, who I don't know if he's actually in the room at the moment, I think, has famously contributed to the code base that they work for you when he was an MP. It's more that the fastest way to understand what programmers do is to learn how to code. You can then forget the coding, but it's just the quickest way into that sort of systems thinking. So I'm not saying it as a long term, and there may be other and better teaching strategies. Happy to discuss them with you. In terms of standing for a counsellor, the thing is that if you're, in a sense, the problem is, standing for a counsellor, how could any of you stand the loss of influence and importance compared to just being an ordinary citizen? At the moment, the democratic system, the democratic process is so broken in this country that there is no real kudos or credit for participating in that way. And I think that's going to be a big barrier to overcome, which is a much broader one. I would say, though, we are the most politically astute and active bunch of geeks that I know. One of the things about open tech is the people who come along are those who care about these issues, who care about it much more than just the technology. So, in a sense, I'm addressing this particular audience. I do think there is this sense that, yeah, we can't just wait for the people to come to us and sort of touch the hems of our garments and be inducted into the geek way. It has to be done slightly more subtly than that. And the bit about the sword and stuff like that, I was only joking earlier.
I'm afraid we've only got time for one more question for Bill. And the chap at the front in the black put his hand up earlier.
Richard.
Yes. People like us are informed by people like you and also our own research and the people we follow and stuff like that. The majority of the British population, on the other hand, are actually informed by, largely speaking, general journalists writing for other newspapers who don't actually understand any of it at any scientific level, any technological level. And that's where the majority of the population get their information from. How do we turn this around? How do we loop that around so that the people who inform the public at large are actually informed themselves?
The best way we can loop it around and ensure that people who inform the public at large are informed themselves is by holding them to account, by writing nasty, vicious, vitriolic articles such as Bad Science in The Guardian, which take them to task for their inadequacies and failures and embarrass them in front of their peers. And saying that, I think it's Ben's turn.
Can you switch the thingy on?
Just warming up.
You ready, Ben?
Yes.
Oh, how much did you charge for the Philips branding on your presentation?
Do you think that will go away?
Another fiver.
Oi.
Hello. I wrote my talk during Bill's because I didn't want to give my normal talk, and like Bill, I've decided that I want to build a Reich. So this is a sort of recruitment drive. Is it too soon for jokes like that? So this is a recruitment drive, and I'm going to give you some very poorly thought through ideas about what we can do really to sort of exploit the shits and giggles economy that we all work in for the most part. You know, we all do things where we don't really make very much money out of the things that we really care about, and we now recognise that work is called work for a reason. But then there's a lot of good stuff that needs to be done, but which won't be funded, and so people do it in a sort of slightly ad hoc, chaotic way for their own amusement, like they run blogs taking the piss out of spine wizards and chiropractors and that sort of thing. But it's my sort of vague belief that I've developed over the course of the last 25 minutes of sitting here, that it's possible that if you sort of built a skeleton in a very clever computery way, then other people would appear and put flesh on it, just for the sheer fun of it. So the basic problems are people want to know about science. And people need good quality information so that they can make meaningful decisions about their own healthcare, and that's fine and that's important, but it's a bit more boring. And then lastly, so far, journalists and regulators have sort of failed to do these meaningful things that we'd want them to do, and so there might be room to find a way of doing it a little bit better. So without wanting to waste your time, I'm assuming you're all vaguely on side with the idea that science coverage is sort of lazy, venal, misleading and inaccurate. Just very briefly, firstly, the basic problem with science coverage in mainstream media, and the reason why blogs and independent people are in a position to do it much better, is that firstly, they make commercial decisions about what they think is interesting on the basis of rather stupid criteria, and they neglect nerds, and you neglect your nerds at great cultural and economic cost. And secondly, they cover things that are just plain wrong. So this is a fairly typical British science media story about how all men will have big willies. This was like a major national news story about how the human race will divide into two species, like the Eloi and the Morpok in H.G. Wells' Time Machine. And it was interesting. It was interesting actually because it was built on. It was basically made out of a press release PR companies offer something called advertising equivalent exposure. The, a company goes to them, they say, we want to get our brand in the paper, and the PR companies say, well, we know that the easiest way of doing that is by inventing some completely bullshit formula for the perfect cup of tea or the sexiest wiggle, or maybe some kind of scientific research or survey that we can get them to put in the news. And on this occasion, it was Bravo Evolution Report. Interesting things about this, though, are, firstly, it was completely wrong. It said that men and women would divide into two species. Humans would divide into two species. There'd be the sort of posh people who would be tall and attractive and glamorous like us with large breasts and long penises. And then the sort of cleaners and the chronically unemployed would have children together and they'd become a short, misshapen proletariat. And, you know, speciation, dividing into two species, divided by a social habitat, like a reproductive barrier, but in the same place physically, is very rarely seen, even in sort of other species. And also, I think we all have an intuitive sense that short, fat, ugly, bald men with a lot of money and tall, attractive, glamorous women can be remarkably resourceful in love. So it was wrong and it was stupid, but it was written by a guy called Oliver Curry, who's a proper researcher at LSE, in exchange for several thousand pounds, I think, off Bravo, the kind of fast cars and big tits cable channel. And it was interesting to me, firstly, that nothing that this man ever does in his real academic career will ever get media coverage like this stupid made-up story. But secondly, it was interesting to me that... The PR companies know that the way to get bullshit into newspapers is through science. This went around the world, this story. There it is on Fox. There it is in Australia, Sydney Morning Herald, somewhere in Spanish. I don't even know what language that is. This is a big story. And the equation stories, obviously, have their own life. These are just some from the Daily Mail. This is Apathy Sketchpad. So this is an interesting illustration, I think, and this is Science Punk doing all the ones in the BBC. Household chopsticks, biscuit dunking, the formula for which bread to use for mopping gravy. This is, the point I'm trying to make to you is I'm not cherry picking here. These are quite a significant chunk of what passes for science coverage in UK media. And this slide actually demonstrates one of the points which I wish to make in the talk I've written in the last 25 minutes, which is that if the bloke who writes this blog had just got annoyed about this one day and gone to the Daily Telegraph website and searched for all of their stupid equation stories, he would have amused himself. But by writing it all down in one place, he amused other people. And also, he has allowed me to steal his work and then combine it with this work done by Frank Swain from Science Punk. And now we've got this sort of quite significant barrage of information, just really from people being a bit annoyed about something and then writing down what they've discovered. So at the most sort of basic level, blogs, in the sense that they allow people to sort of put their snarky research in the public domain and make it usable to others, represent quite a useful social structure for helping us take the piss out of people. The second thing, obviously, is that newspapers are misleading and boring and just make things up. Do you really want examples of this? They're not that interesting. It will make you laugh and it will make you cry. This is the front page of The Independent on Sunday, filled with lies. Basically, a bunch of journalists in their 30s and early 40s, about 10 years ago, decided they wanted to legalise cannabis. So The Independent on Sunday had this big campaign to legalise cannabis. Then about 10 years later, they changed their mind. I think their children were in their teens and they'd started smoking weed. And they just felt really uncomfortable about that. But they didn't have the sort of moral strength of character to say, we're not very happy about our children smoking dope, and if we could, we'd sort of cover them in protective clothing and they'd never take any risks. So instead of like being honest and saying that their views had changed, they pretended that the cannabis had changed and it was now 25 times stronger. And that was a lie, as you can see from these slides. Also interesting, actually, in 1981, at the time of the Just Say No campaign with Nancy Reagan and everything, and Zamo, the Americans were saying that cannabis in 1981 was 30 times stronger than it was in the 60s. So if it's 25 times stronger now than it was 25 years ago, it was that's like a crystal in a plant pot, like dark quark gluon plasma. This is a completely made-up story. This is all of those sort of undercover MRSA superbug positive swab scandal stories. They all came out of the same lab, and it was a garden shed, and it was by a man run by a man who didn't know anything about microbiology, and had a mail-order PhD in microbiology, but was described by newspapers as leading expert, blah-de-blah. And then, of course, this is MMR, and that's Andrew Wakefield, and these are two pornographic actresses who he's at a party with, and I'm hanging out with Bill. So that just goes to show the wages of sin, really. So anyway, news coverage isn't very good, and I've written a book about that if you want to read it, but you can read it all for free on the internet. More importantly, what can we do about all this in a shits and giggles economy? Sort of beyond just taking the piss out of people is sort of where I was trying to get to, because somebody thrust the title Beyond Bad Science onto this session, I noticed as I arrived. So firstly, there are guidelines, and this is a suggestion of my friend Tom Steinberg, who, as you know, is a genius. And he says, you know, a really good rhetorical device is if you set out some clear guidelines for what journalists should be doing, then you can go and invite them to sign up to them, to your really reasonable guidelines, and then either they do, in which case when they transgress, you can sort of say, but you've signed up to these really sensible guidelines, or they refuse to sign up to your really sensible guidelines, and then every time they transgress them, you have the opportunity to say, well, it's not really surprising that they transgress them because they refuse to sign up to our perfectly sensible guidelines. This is the sort of brilliant passive-aggressive campaigning that My Society are becoming famous for. And so me and Vaughan from Mindhacks, who might be here, are you here? Best science blogger in the world. Hello. He's actually my hero. He's, like, to me, the perfect instantiation of what Danny O'Brien said about how in the past everyone was famous for 15 minutes, and in the future everyone will be famous for 15 people. I met him having a slash in the bogs at the Fitzroy Tavern, and he said, oh, thanks for linking to my blog the other day. And I said, oh, that's all right, what's your blog? And he said, Mindhacks. And I was like, no way! I couldn't believe it. The man is my hero. So brings me on to point two, which is, this is a bit like the PowerPoint game. Have you ever played the PowerPoint game where you just download random PowerPoint slides off Google and then put them all on a thumb drive? It's like sort of nerd charades. And then you have to, you just take random PowerPoint presentations and then you have to present them sight unseen to everybody else at the party, 1 minute per slide for the first five slides, sort of management takeover bids and areas of science about which you know nothing. So yeah, competition, number two. So the good, really good thing that blogs can do is we can be better than mainstream media in some quite interesting ways. So we can be better than them in the way that Vaughan's produces the best popular science coverage on neuroscience of anyone I've seen anywhere. But we can also mock their flaws. And the reasons why we're better are structural themselves. You know, we can reference primary material. If I'm taking the piss out of somebody else on my blog, I link to them so you can see if I'm strawmanning them in a really idiotic way. Whereas when Melanie Phillips replies to my piece that was in the newspaper 3 days after it was printed and responds only to one sentence in the ninth paragraph and ignores the entirety of the rest of my argument, no one will ever know. So we reference primary material and you can see very transparently that we're good. With blogs you can have like a range of content. So you can be really nerdy at one point, and or you can be really sort of populist and accessible. You can also sort of do investigative work, and I think the Door story was really interesting for that. Door is a miracle cure for dyslexia invented by a paint entrepreneur. How long have I been talking for? Is it really only 2:40? Fuck me. Spin this out. Door, a miracle cure for dyslexia invented by a paint millionaire using NASA technology, except it didn't use NASA technology, and NASA actually put out a press release eventually because they were so bored of this, saying this man has nothing to do with us. Imagine that. They had to take a break from putting people into space to slap down a quack in the UK. How brilliant is that? They were being promoted heavily in mainstream media by a bunch of people, like sort of famous, who's that famous rugby player who was on Come Dancing? Does anyone know? We're so isolated from mainstream media. We have no idea. He's amazingly famous. Not Matt Lawson. It's not Scott Quinnell. Anyway, some really famous sports personality was appearing all over TV and stuff. and saying, this miracle cure for dyslexia has amazingly improved my life. Turned out he was on the board of the company and being paid for his promotional activity. And it was... what? Kenny Logan. Kenny Logan, yes. Yeah, and tonight with Trevor McDonald did two whole promotional half hours on how brilliant this miracle cure for dyslexia was, even though it was total tosh, you know the evidence for it was basically non-existent. And they at the end of the programmes, they had this thing saying, if you'd like more information, if you'd like to find out more, if you've been affected by the issues in this, call this number. And it was actually the sales line for Door. They were slapped down by Ofcom twice, but carried on doing it. So were Richard and Judy. Meanwhile, bloggers were sort of running around, sort of collecting all this stuff on them and sort of doing really great praises of the evidence for whether this stuff worked, and obviously it didn't. Then sort of getting really obsessive and hanging out in the forums for the parents who were having the programme. And they spotted that the company were going bust before anybody else did, because they saw that people were having their appointments cancelled. And you had to pay like 2,500 quid up front in advance to pay for your whole programme. And people were having their appointments cancelled, and the company was obviously going bust, and people started blogging on this, and then a blogger called Gimpy was blogging on the accounts, and he didn't know very much about accounts, but he found another blogger who was an accountant who took apart the accounts and explained that this was a company that was in serious trouble. And then overnight people saw that the Door offices in Australia had shut down, so a blogger in Australia put up this thing saying, Door in Australia have shut down. So they started, you know, producing all of this really interesting stuff. Meanwhile, at exactly the same time, mainstream media continued to promote this programme to the extent that Radio 4's flagship investigative journalism programme, You and Yours, had Kenny Logan actually on, and they had this big sort of promotional thing of, like, you know, Kenny Logan says that, you know, his dyslexia was improved by the Door miracle cure for dyslexia. By this point, the company was in administration in Australia. It was clearly about to go into an administration in the UK. If anybody gave them £2,500, they were simply going to lose it, and it seemed a bit odd that You and Yours were still actively promoting it. And they said... quite, you know, because they people like to pretend that radio and TV is like a bit like the internet and it's interactive. So they said, and if you've got any interesting comments on this, just get in touch. You can email us or text us or tweet us. And so all of these bloggers were going, I've got some information for you. The fucking company's going bust. Don't promote it. This is really bad. And they didn't read out any of those on the air. So that was an interesting example of how bloggers can be better. But then also... I'm so hungover. Also, structures, clever use of technology to make things better. So you know about the spine wizards, the chiropractors. They're suing my friend Simon Singh, because he said that they promote bogus treatments, which they do. So they can sue me if they want to, but I don't have any money. Whereas, to be fair, Simon is a multiple millionaire. So this was interesting, really, not because they were suing him, but because nobody had heard of chiropractors. So was it nice of them to sue him? Not really. Was it wise of them to sue him? Definitely not. So now, firstly, there's been a lot of mainstream media coverage of how dodgy chiropractors are. But secondly, there have been a lot of blogs springing up, pulling apart all of their evidence, cross-referencing each other, producing large sort of authoritative texts on the dodginess of chiropractors. But also better than that, there's a website called Quackometer, run by my friend Andy Lewis, which has this automated text search thing, which basically runs around the internet like a robot spy, looking for websites that have kind of classic quack words on them, and then it searches through them, and then it looks to see if they're dodgy or not, and it can sort of spot the semantic footprint of a quack or of a skeptic as well, you know, so it sort of correctly identifies that I am not peddling the bullshit that I mock. So him and this other blogger called Alan Hennis went, okay, so chiropractors deny that they're promoting bogus treatments like, you know, chiropractic for in baby colic and that sort of thing. So they set up this thing to run out onto the internet and find every single person who's a member of the British Chiropractic Association or the General Chiropractic Council, and then find out what services they're offering on their website and what diseases they're trying to treat, and found 550 people who were contravening the guidelines, and then sent this big long list of names to the General Chiropractic Council and said, I'd like to make a formal complaint about these 550 people. And they said, I'm afraid we can't take complaints like that, they have to be in written form. So then they sent them the list of names in a big letter, slightly childish, but there you go. And then they wrote back and said, no, we have to have separate letters for each person. Thinking that somehow this would be a problem for some nerds. So obviously they just knocked up a quick mail merge and sent 550 letters all in one envelope, and we're waiting to see if the envelope thing is a problem too. So very briefly, the thing that I'm really interested in is there anything that we can do to sort of help people do that kind of thing? Because all of this has sprung up spontaneously. A lot of them sprung up because I installed a copy of PHPBP, like the dodgy forum server, on my website. And then there were loads of people writing lots of really, really cool stuff. And we felt disappointed that this cool stuff was hidden on the forum. So me and Steve, the guy who moderates it for me, went in there and said, OK, we're going to shut down the forum unless 12 of you start blogs in the next week. Which was quite a nice seed of sort of new blog activity. And then lots of other blogs started up. And then we've set up this thing called Bad Science Blogs, which is basically a sort of big aggregator, which brings together all of the best of all of those things together. But what we'd really like to do, but we don't have any nerd, we don't have any like really clever nerds on board, is to sort of set up clever things with metadata so that we can have basically, here's all of the things that have been said about chiropractors, here are all of the things that have been said about DAW, and sort of links to headlines of that, and here are all the things that have been said about DAW regulatory-wise, and here are the things that have been said about DAW evidence-wise, and that sort of thing. And if anybody wants to help, that would be lovely, because this talk is about building my Reich, after all. There's something else that I was going to build, but I've run out of time, so thanks.
Thank you very much, Ben. Right, we've got time for some questions. So who's first? Please stand when you speak and put your hands up. Any questions? Not one. Oh, chap at the front.
Hello.
Hi.
It's a question about usability, and it's all right, it's kind of both of you. A lot of the science blocks that I see are either written in either quite dense science English or sciences, or they don't have a previously in this story. So you sort of come in and say, as you all know, this company is incredibly dodgy, and then a large sort of tranche, but without much looking back. And in technology, we see lots of really great computer programs which are utterly unusable because programmers aren't usability or psychology experts. I just wondered, how do you see that change? Do you think there's any way that we can get good bloggers to write better so that newcomers can understand it, and good programmers write programs that people actually want to use and can use?
I almost sort of see the opposite problem. Often I find I go to... I think it's very, very difficult when what you get a lot on the sort of science blogs, especially the science blogs attacking other people, is somebody doing really obsessively one fragment of the story, which is really, really brilliant. The problem is they often feel obliged to have like three paragraphs introducing the background to the story, which is really boring to read until you get to the bit that's new if you already know it. But the other problem, as you say, is if you just go in cold, you get this obsessive, like, why the fuck do I care about that one reference from the third legal document from the court case stuff? I think what would be really, really, really useful is a kind of semi-structured, semi-automated wiki for people who are doing the kind of disseminated investigative journalism, which is basically what this is, to use to kind of build to build stories in, so that you can have kind of, you know, here are some background posts, here are some posts about, you know, whatever the structure of the story is, and to have metadata in each individual post that will feed automatically onto that wiki would be brilliant. Does that make sense? Am I talking utter bollocks?
I mean, I think it could be made to work. I mean, what you also want, of course, is guidelines and transparency. And I think we need two new websites. We need one called theycodeforyou.org. which holds up programmers, and of course we need for Ben and his ilk, theyrantforyou.org, which does the same for them.
Yes. I mean, I'm really going to try and explain my sort of auto-wiki thing to you, because I think it's really important, because there is a lot of disseminated investigative journalism going on by people for nothing. Basically, for a wiki you need to constantly update it, but for any of the stories that we work on, there is a natural structure, which is basically, this is the background, these are other things that are like this company, these are the claims made by this company, annotated, this is each story sort of taking it down. And I wish I could express clearly my fantasy of how you could have like an automated page that would draw all of those things together. Or maybe I should just leave that to you because you're cleverer than me.
A gentleman at the back in the black.
That is great, although often the people that you're investigating change what they're saying quite swiftly when they know that you're changing. For example, the McTimony Chiropractor Association just sent out an email to every single one of their 500 members saying, the skeptics are coming, take down your websites, we have. And we went, what? We went to the website of like this huge, like, you know, health professionals regulator, and they'd taken their website down because they were so afraid of us.
A gentleman at the front in the blue.
So,
Stand up.
Is the problem more that the English graduates can't do computing, or the computing graduates can't do English?
I know many computing graduates who are perfectly capable of doing English. You are indeed yourself one of them, Quentin. I think the problem is that English graduates are not don't feel they need to know computing. It's like they don't feel they need to know statistics, they don't feel they need to know the scientific method. There are vast areas of culture that are just absent from their lives, and we need to do something about that, and I think that's what we both believe.
And gentlemen at the front in the black.
So if I could follow that up, do you not both think that this whole problem could be solved by the generation, by the teaching of the youngest leaders?
Well, stuff changes over time, doesn't it? I mean, it does surprise me that nobody gets taught it. I mean, my personal bugbear is obviously evidence-based medicine. I mean, the basic science of how do you know if something's good for you or bad for you seems like a really important thing to know about and be taught about. And it is about half of all science coverage is health. And it's... Oh, about half of all science coverage is health. So people obviously have an interest in that sort of thing. You know, the Daily Mail's bizarre ongoing philosophical project of dividing all inanimate objects into the ones that either cause or cure cancer is quite a good illustration of that. I think, basically, I would strongly consider abolishing about half of all the science teaching that people get at school and replacing it with basic nerd skills and basic evidence-based medicine skills, because I think that's the sort of applied science that matters to people the most. Yeah.
I could go for that.
I'm afraid we're almost out of time. We've got time for one more question. The gentleman at the front was the last one to put his hand up.
Given that you wish to build this wiki, to me this seems to imply a level of cooperation between the people feeding the information in. And this, in a forum like this, cooperation is locally given. I'm not quite so sure that in the non-open source world, let alone journalism, such cooperation is kind of a way of life.
Actually, no, I mean, that's the real sort of shame is that all of these bloggers work really closely together and email each other constantly and are sharing information all the time. But I think what we really need is basically some way of bringing them all together in a way that makes it into a coherent story for people who are just coming as outsiders looking for the information, because at the moment it's really atomized. I don't know if the automatic wiki thing is the best way. I don't know if the sort of big front page aggregator we've got just for random news stories is necessarily the right way. But I think what I'm really hoping is that some absolute ninja nerd in this room will have an amazing idea of what you can do about the fact that there are lots and lots of people doing really, really, really good, amazingly well-researched, atomized nuggets of investigative journalism, what you can do to try and produce structures for that that will make it more easily readable, but also make it a bit more efficient about who's looking where, flag up gaps in stories that need to be hunted out, and that sort of thing.
One very quick comment from Bill, and then we have to end it.
Just got a tweet from Emily Bell of The Guardian, who's watching, saying, how about an open tech with kid-friendly parallel stream, which would make it easier for those of us wrangling weekends? And of course, then we could induct the kids into the science and geek way. So that will happen next year, I'm sure.
Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Ben. And if you all want to continue staying in your seats, I will be moderating the next session, which is called Women in Tech. Please come back for it.